All right, I think I'm recording. So this is about 2:31, and we're almost done with the autonomic nervous system. Today is November 4th, and don't forget, next week there's no class on Monday because it's a holiday of some kind. Right? It's Veterans Day, right, Veterans Day. So campus will be closed. I'm sure the library is closed and everything is closed, okay, on Monday. Here's your sign-in sheet, so go ahead, pass that around. All right, so let's compare and contrast a couple nervous systems. And in terms of motor, how can you break the motor nervous system down? Motor, what's another name for motor? All right, we got to get those neurons cranking. Efferent, yeah, the efferent nervous system. If we want to break it down into two functional divisions, what would those divisions be? Okay, that's close. Somebody said parasympathetic and sympathetic, but we're not quite there yet. What are all the effector organs in your body? What are the effector organs that you have that can respond to stimuli or commands from your brain?
Glands.
Glands, that's one kind. So we got glands. Oh, that's nice. Glands. Smooth. Muscle, cardiac, and then somebody said another one.
Skeletal
muscle. Should I put it in that column? No, I should put it over here. All right, skeletal. All right, so go back in the very first chapter that we study introduction to nervous system. See how the motor nervous system is broken down? Two columns. So what would we call this over here? Going to skeletal muscle. That would be? Okay, it's going to basically all the places on your body except for things inside cavities. What's another name for a body? Soma. All right, so this would be the somatic nervous system. And over here would be? Yeah, you could say visceral more commonly. Right, visceral means in body cavities. So yeah, you're really pretty warm right there. But maybe I would like to call it what? Autonomic nervous system. All right, so we could break the efferent nervous system down functionally by these two different designations. All right, so I don't know. Is the autonomic nervous system important? Yeah, because it's controlling what? Most of the things in your body. Everything besides skeletal muscle. So it's really, really important. All right, so from the central nervous system, from CNS, to an effector, what does an effector do for you? What does it produce? It produces a response. How many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to an effector in the somatic nervous system? Okay, you should have a nice clear picture of that. Showed a lot of slides, but I don't want to just show you those slides over again. Okay, because I think it's really helpful to write this stuff down. So there's what? There's just one neuron. And you probably have a picture in your mind, well, that's just a nice multipolar neuron, right? Because that's a motor neuron. What about for the autonomic nervous system? CNS to an effector. How many neurons?
Two.
There are two. And they've got names. What do we call the first one that's just leaving the brain or the spinal cord?
Presynaptic.
Okay. Presynaptic is pretty good. Maybe there's a term that's used a little bit more commonly. Yeah, because between the two neurons is a ganglion, so there's a preganglionic and a postganglionic. But at the ganglion, of course, there is a synapse. So everybody would know what you're saying. The first one is the preganglionic. And number two would be the post. Postganglionic. Okay. Presynaptic, postsynaptic, a little bit more general. If we were going to say preganglionic, postganglionic, immediately people are going to start thinking about autonomic nervous system. Okay. So when you talk about the autonomic nervous system, might as well use something that people just automatically key into. So say ganglionic, preganglionic, postganglionic. Okay. So two fibers back to back. All right, now the autonomic nervous system, we can break down into two pieces. What are the two pieces of the autonomic nervous system? All right. Think. Yes, sympathetic and parasympathetic. We talked about the differences, the different effects they have on organs. What's the best way for you to think about the relationship between the parasympathetic and sympathetic? In almost all cases, what's the relationship going to be? They're going to be antagonistic to each other. So if one speeds up the heart, the other one slows it down. All right, so it seems maybe not sympathetic. All right, sympathetic. So that sounds kind of futile, right, if you have two systems working against each other. But what's the beauty of an antagonistic control system? Yeah, precise control and balance, like the brake and gas pedal in your car, like the triceps, biceps, all right? And here's a nervous system that is set up just that way. Okay, now what about outflow for a parasympathetic nervous system? How does it leave the central nervous system? It doesn't leave everywhere. As a matter of fact, in your mind, you should think of two places where nerve signals can leave your central nervous system. How can signals get out of your central nervous system? Maybe we should have to go back one more step. What makes up your central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. Okay. Can nerves leave both the brain and the spinal cord? Yes or no? And if you say yes, you'd have to give me an example. Okay, let's say yes. What's an example of a nerve that leaves the brain? And how many are there? Oh, it's a good thing you guys got Monday off. Yeah, we call them what? Cranial nerves. There's 12 of them, right? And remember on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German view to hop. Remember all those? So you should know all the names of those guys. Those are cranial nerves. What's another kind of nerve? Spinal nerves that leave the spinal cord. Right? So nerves can leave the central nervous system via cranial nerves or spinal nerves. And what about for parasympathetic? How does it leave the CNS? It is craniosacral. Right? Craniosacral. Craniosacral. That means that it leaves through some cranial nerves and also through some spinal nerves at the level of the sacrum. And maybe I'll just throw a really nice picture real quick on the teleprompter right here that shows that. What chapter is this? 15, I think. Yeah, 15. So where's a nice diagram that shows this? I think this compares everything. All right, so this blue here and here, maybe it's purple, who cares, turquoise, don't know what it is. All right, that is what? Parasympathetic, because it's what? Craniosacral outflow. Now, what about the sympathetic nervous system? What color is that? Green. Okay, on the diagram. And what do we call that? Thoracolumbar outflow for sympathetic nervous system. But in every case, whether it is craniosacral or thoracolumbar, how many nerves does it take to get to an effector organ? Two. What's the first one called? Just leaving the CNS. The preganglionic fiber. What's the second one called? The postganglionic fiber. What's in between them? Synapse. Which is, and if you put a bunch of those cell bodies someplace, it's called a ganglion in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so I don't know, hopefully this is stimulating a little bit of a discussion we had last time. Maybe a little bit. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, we're going to talk about that. Two different ways for the two different autonomic nervous systems. You want to go over, let's go over the parasympathetic first. All right, so here's parasympathetic. This is the preganglionic fiber is really long. It goes all the way to the effector organ. And then the ganglion right here Autonomic ganglion is right on the target organ, it's right on the heart, right on the iris, all right? And then the postganglionic cell is really short, all right? But for the sympathetic nervous system, it's kind of the other way around, all right? The preganglionic fiber is short. In a lot of cases, it goes just to the sympathetic chain ganglion where it stops. And where's that sympathetic chain ganglion? Is it close to the spinal cord? Yeah, here it is right here. It's very close to the spinal cord. Maybe I can find a better picture. Very, very close to the spinal cord. All right, here's the spinal cord. Here are the vertebral bodies. And then just lateral to the vertebral bodies is the sympathetic chain. So the preganglionic fiber is really short and only has to get into the sympathetic chain right here where it might synapse. All right, and then the postganglionic fiber is long and it goes all the way to the effector organ. Okay, I'm going to draw on the board where we left off last time. Yeah, let's go back to that one. You don't have all the little pieces to it? All right, let me zoom. That probably helps. All right, so the salient features are somatic nervous system, one neuron, all the way from CNS to effector organ. Autonomic nervous system, two neurons. The preganglionic and the postganglionic. I would say, yeah, that's it. All right, now, in the ganglion, which I don't have on the slide, I actually need to show about four or five slides at one time without having to flip back and forth. What kind of synapse do we have in an autonomic ganglion? How many different kinds of synapses are you aware of? There are only two. One is chemical. What's the other one? Electrical. What kind of synapse do we have in a ganglion, autonomic ganglion? Chemical. Yeah, what's the name of the chemical, the general name of that chemical that goes from the preganglionic to the postganglionic?
Acetylcholine.
Okay. It's called a neurotransmitter. But the specific name, because there are different kinds of neurotransmitters, one specific name would be acetylcholine. All right, so the neurotransmitter that's always used at the ganglion between the preganglionic and postganglionic, what carries information across the synapse is acetylcholine. In every case, whether it is parasympathetic or sympathetic, doesn't matter. It's always going to be acetylcholine. So in your diagrams, do you see those little dots between the pre- and postganglionic cells? That's the neurotransmitter, which is acetylcholine. Okay. Now, what is the neurotransmitter at the effector organ? It changes. For the parasympathetic nervous system, it is acetylcholine. But for sympathetic neurons, postganglionic fibers, it is what? I'm just going to put NE standing for norepinephrine. Norepinephrine. So those are the two main neurotransmitters that are used. One, acetylcholine is used by all preganglionic fibers, but the postganglionic fibers, it's different. And that helps explain why the sympathetic nervous system has a different effect than the parasympathetic nervous system, because it uses different neurotransmitters in the postganglionic fiber. All right, so how are you doing? Some people had some questions at the beginning of class. Is that sort of making a little bit more sense?
I'm with you every time you get up to that part right there, because it's in reference to
cranial sacral? Okay, right here and right here. Okay, which one did I draw? I drew a spinal cord, right? I started with a spinal cord. Could there be any cranial nerves coming out of the spinal cord? Because cranial nerves come out of the brain. All right, so what I drew on the board last time was from the level of the thorax or the lumbar region. So what I was specifically drawing was an outflow pathway for the sympathetic nervous system, but not the parasympathetic nervous system. So what's on the screen, okay, would be the sympathetic nervous system, but not parasympathetic. Sympathetic nerves have to go through the sympathetic chain ganglia to get someplace.
Always.
Yeah.
But they don't always have to have that spinal.
Okay. Let's look at some examples. All right. So here's spinal cord, right? So it's going to issue sympathetic nerves. How does, what root is the motor root coming out of the spinal cord? It's the ventral root. Ventral is what? Anterior. The vertebral bodies are anterior, right? Because what's posterior on a vertebrae? Spinous process, right? So are you kind of oriented? This is the anterior part of the vertebral column. So here is the ventral root. This is the motor root. The preganglionic sympathetic fibers leave the ventral root, and then they enter the sympathetic chain. They all enter. They all have to enter. And this one here, this is just called a ramus communicantes, and it's colored white. Why does that have a white color? Because the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. All right, so it looks white. It enters the sympathetic chain. And once that fiber is in the sympathetic chain, it has a number of options. It can ascend through the sympathetic chain. It can descend, right? Or it can actually synapse on the postganglionic cell right inside this little ganglion right here. All right, so that's three options. The fourth option is that it can pass all the way through to another ganglion someplace. So that other collateral ganglion is going to replace the function of the sympathetic chain. And so a nerve, as it goes through the sympathetic chain to a collateral ganglion someplace, these are all going to be what we call splanchnic nerves. All right, so I'm going to say some more about that. That's a splanchnic nerve. So this nerve right here is a preganglionic fiber that has just passed right through the sympathetic chain. It started here in the spinal cord, entered the spinal nerve, entered the sympathetic chain via the white ramus communicantes, passing right through into a splanchnic nerve. But before that signal gets to an effector organ, guess what it has to do? This is still all the preganglionic fiber. It has to synapse someplace on a collateral ganglion or prevertebral ganglion. Collateral or prevertebral ganglion is the same thing. All right, so we were drawing this last time. Maybe I would want to do that again really quick. But you have a question. Yeah, the splanchnic nerve carries... Yeah, carries only preganglionic fibers. Okay? Yep, so that preganglionic fiber is entering via the white ramus communicantes, passes right through. Can't go directly to an effector organ because it has to synapse at a ganglion someplace. And since it didn't synapse in the sympathetic chain ganglia, there is another ganglion in front of the vertebral column, and we call those the prevertebral ganglia.
Okay.
It only synapse once. How many neurons does it take for an autonomic outflow system to get to an effector organ?
Two.
And what are they called? The preganglionic? Postganglionic. All right. There's only one little modification to the scheme that I'll talk about very last. Usually there's what? Always at least one exception to the rule. This is a pretty important exception. All right. Well, let's just draw that picture once again. What should I erase? I guess I'll erase this over here. All right. Unless I say, ooh. All right, so just step through all those little basic steps, just like that. All right, so I think I started even, you know, something like this. Ah, what's that? Spinal cord, okay? And so let's just say this is from T1 to L2, what nervous system? What autonomic nervous system? Sympathetic, right? What about parasympathetic? Can it leave your CNS that way? No, because parasympathetic is craniosacral outflow. All right, so this is only sympathetic. All right, so let's draw this out like this. All right, generally, what's this guy? This is a, yeah, it's a root, and this is a root, okay? And what root is this one up here? This is the dorsal root. I don't want to spell it out, but if you want me to spell it out, let me know. Dorsal root. All right, so this one here is the ventral root. Which one is motor? Oh, sorry. I don't know what I did there. Ventral root. Okay, which one is motor? Ventral root. So how about if I just draw a little arrow like that? Could I draw a little arrow like this up here on the dorsal root? Right? Because the dorsal root is 100% sensory. That's all there's to it. And what's this little enlargement right here? Dorsal root ganglia. Good. And so remember, roots are never mixed in function. They're either 100% sensory or 100% motor, one or the other. Now, what do we call this segment right here? Where the two roots come together? That's the spinal nerve. What's the function of the spinal nerve? What's the function? Is it afferent or efferent? It's mixed. Yeah, mixed. So I'll just put mixed right here. All right. But since we're interested in sympathetic outflow, the sympathetic nerves don't leave and go to an effector organ via the spinal nerve directly. It leaves the spinal nerve, and it goes to another ganglion over here. Okay? And tell me what's the definition of a ganglion?
Nerve cell body.
It's a bunch of nerve cell bodies. Yeah, and dendrites. All right, so I'll put a nerve cell body right here. So this fiber leaves the ventral root, goes into the spinal nerve, enters the sympathetic chain, and maybe it synapses on a nerve cell body right here. So this, what's the name of this first cell? This is the preganglionic cell. All right, well, let's label this big circle. This is what? The sympathetic chain ganglia. And you can see it on the picture on the slide. That's like an auxiliary spinal cord on either side of the vertebral column for the sympathetic nervous system. All right. Then, here's the cell body. The cell body has an axon coming out of it. It re-enters the spinal nerve, right? So this flows like that in the spinal nerve, and then it follows the spinal nerve to wherever it's going in the body. All right, so here is the preganglionic cell, here's the postganglionic cell. What do we call this bridge right here from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain? It's got a color. Why does it have that color? Because it's myelinated. All right, so this is the white ramus communicantes, or the white ramus communicans. Right? But if this nerve is going to, if this information is going to rejoin the spinal nerve, it leaves the sympathetic chain and it goes back. Now, what's the nature of this preganglionic fiber? Myelinated or not myelinated? It's not myelinated, so this is the gray ramus communicantes. Okay, but there's another possible scenario. Maybe we have a preganglionic fiber that enters the sympathetic chain and it passes right through. Right? It can pass right through the sympathetic chain without synapsing. So this is still the preganglionic fiber. There is another ganglion someplace, and we call it a ganglion because it's loaded with nerve cell bodies. And then here's a preganglionic fiber that goes to an effector organ. So here's preganglionic, here's postganglionic. This ganglia is anterior to the vertebral column. All right, so we would call this a collateral ganglion. This is CG, collateral ganglion. And this nerve that connects the sympathetic chain with this collateral ganglion is always a splanchnic. I still didn't spell it right. Splanchnic. Splanchnic nerve. All right, so the splanchnic nerve carries preganglionic fibers to a collateral or prevertebral ganglion someplace. The spinal nerve? Splanchnic nerve. Preganglionic. Because how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ? Two. So here is one, here is two. The first one is what we call the preganglionic fiber. The second one is what we call the postganglionic fiber. That's it. That's how that works. And what kind of synapse? Again, what kind of synapse is that?
Chemical.
That's a chemical synapse. So there are chemicals. What's the general name of these chemicals?
Neurotransmitters.
And here we have neurotransmitters released by the preganglionic fiber. What's always the name of the neurotransmitter that's released in a ganglion? It's always going to be acetylcholine. But now the postganglionic fiber is going to release neurotransmitter on the effector organ. What is this neurotransmitter called? This is norepinephrine, right? Because this is the sympathetic nervous system. That's a sympathetic nervous system. If it was parasympathetic, this neurotransmitter would be acetylcholine as well. All right, so I think this is what we did last time. Okay. All right, so in your book, you've got some pretty good isolated examples of this. All right, right here, with some other interesting details. All right, so here is a nice cross-section of the spinal cord. It's going to involve the sympathetic chain. So what nervous system is this? Is this parasympathetic or sympathetic? Right, because it's leaving through the thorax. Right, so here are some preganglionic cells. Look at where the cell bodies are. They're in the lateral horn. Right, that's always going to be the case. Leaves the ventral root, goes into the spinal nerve, but it doesn't follow the spinal nerve to the effector organ because it's got to get into the sympathetic chain first. How does it get into the sympathetic chain? Via the white ramus communicantes. This particular nerve, we see synapses in the ganglion. So here's a cell body. Here's the postganglionic fiber then that goes to the lung. Another example, here is a preganglionic fiber. In this particular case, we see it ascend a division. It could go up a couple divisions where it synapses on a postganglionic cell, and then that goes to the heart, for instance. All right, but in every case, you see what? The preganglionic cell and the postganglionic cells. Acetylcholine is used here. Norepinephrine is used right there. Let's look at another scenario. This is probably pretty good. All right, so here is lateral horn, some lower thoracic region to L2, nerve cell body in the lateral horn, leaves the, what's this right here? Ventral root, enters the spinal nerve. What kind of fiber is this, preganglionic or postganglionic? It's a preganglionic, right? It enters the sympathetic chain ganglia via the white ramus communicantes, does not synapse right here, but it passes right through. What do we call a nerve that passes right through the sympathetic chain to a prevertebral ganglion? That's a splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic nerve. And what kind of fiber is in the splanchnic nerve? Preganglionic or postganglionic? It's preganglionic. And then here is that synapse in the prevertebral ganglia. So here is the postganglionic neuron that then goes to the digestive tract. Right, so there are different ways that sympathetic outflow works in the system by its anatomy. But the overall writing reason why it looks so complicated kind of looks like a plexus right here. What did we say about a plexus? What's the beauty of a nerve plexus? When you have a bunch of nerves coming together and then diverting out into different parts of your body? Yeah, so if there is a blockage, for instance, in one pathway, nerve signals or information can find its way around to an effector organ via different pathways. All right. Another reason that we see in the sympathetic nervous system is because of the way the sympathetic nervous system works. All right. The parasympathetic nervous system. All right. So here's an example of parasympathetic nervous system. We see one preganglionic fiber stimulating one postganglionic fiber. It stimulates one effector organ. So parasympathetic stimulation is very discrete. It can be very selective in the body. But let's contrast this with the sympathetic nervous system. What do we call this kind of architecture? Is this convergent, a reverberating circuit, or what? If you have one signal here, what does it do? It diverges all over the place, even at the preganglionic fiber. The postganglionic fiber does what? It diverges all over the place. Not just one effector organ, but many effector organs. So the sympathetic nervous system, right, is not discrete. It activates everything in your body when it becomes stimulated. All right, so that's one of the reasons why we have those sympathetic chain ganglia and collateral ganglions, because it's so important to activate your whole body when your sympathetic nervous system becomes triggered. And when does your sympathetic nervous system get triggered? When you're scared. Like if I were to say, okay, put all your books away right now, let's just get that fourth test out of the way right now. Okay? Your sympathetic nervous system's just been activated. Okay, a little perspiration, a little increased heart rate, pupil dilation, okay, increased ventilation. That's all part of the fight or flight response. All right, so there's only one other little modification to this scheme that I want you to be aware of, and it's a really important. And it has to do with mass activation, how your whole body becomes activated when the sympathetic nervous system becomes triggered. All right, so when we look at this figure right here, what would you tell me about this nervous system that's being diagrammed? Is it parasympathetic or sympathetic? How would you say sympathetic? Uh-oh, why did you say sympathetic? It's thoracolumbar outflow. It's going through the sympathetic chain. It's got to be sympathetic, right? I was just kind of pulling your leg there just to see. All right, so here is a sympathetic outflow pathway. And here we see the cell body in the lateral horn leaves the ventral root into the spinal nerve, leaves the spinal nerve via the white ramus communicantes, goes into the sympathetic chain. But is there a synapse here? No. It passes right through into a nerve that's leaving the sympathetic chain. What do we call all nerves that leave the sympathetic chain ganglia? So here's a splanchnic, if it's just passing right through. Here's a splanchnic nerve, right? And I don't want you to know the specific names of the major splanchnic nerves, but here's a splanchnic nerve, and it goes all the way to the adrenal medulla. So what kind of nerve is this one right here, right where I have the cursor? Is that preganglionic or postganglionic? That's pre. And remember, all autonomic outflow systems need how many neurons?
Two.
And here's the first one, the preganglionic. Goes to the adrenal cortex. Remember, the cortex of an organ is what? The deep part? No, I'm wrong. Okay. The cortex is the outer part. The inner part is what we call the medulla. All right, so here it goes to the adrenal gland, but in particular, what? The deep part, and that's called the adrenal medulla. All right, so the preganglionic fiber goes all the way into the adrenal medulla, where it synapses on a cell. So how would you like to think of these cells right here in the adrenal medulla? Do they look like preganglionic cells or postganglionic cells? Can you see that? Well, what's this one here? That's the preganglionic. What's the one after the preganglionic? The postganglionic cells. So these are acting like postganglionic cells. So the adrenal medulla sort of looks like a ganglion in some respects. But when this preganglionic fiber enters the adrenal medulla and stimulates the cells of the adrenal medulla, they don't send electrical information anywhere because they don't have any axons. When they get stimulated, they automatically release norepinephrine and also epinephrine into the adrenal medulla, and then these neurotransmitters are picked up by this capillary, and where do they go after they get into the capillary? Yeah, they're in the blood, and then where do they go? They go everywhere in your body. So here is another scheme for mass activation where we have sympathetic chemicals, namely epinephrine and norepinephrine, being released by the sympathetic nervous system. And where does it go? Everywhere in your body, okay, massively activating the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so the cells of the adrenal medulla act kind of like an endocrine system because they're releasing these compounds directly into the circulation, right, where they have an effect all over the body. So in this particular case, norepinephrine is acting like a hormone. But it's also kind of acting like a neurotransmitter because it's being released by these adrenal medulla cells. So in this particular case, we call epinephrine and norepinephrine neurohormones because, what, it's a combination of both of those effects. All right, so this is that one example where you don't have clearly a preganglionic cell and a postganglionic cell. The postganglionic cells are those of the adrenal medulla that directly release epinephrine into the blood that activate your sympathetic activity all over the body. Yeah? I would say neurohormone, because it'd be, if you were to say neurotransmitter, that would make a lot of sense, all right? But then you're missing out on its action of acting like a hormone, because hormones go into the blood. But if you just say hormone, then you're missing the function that of the release from the adrenal medulla cells as a result of the preganglionic stimulation. So you actually should combine those terms. Okay, so norepinephrine and epinephrine act as neurohormones. And as a matter of fact, in a lot of classes, we don't just study the nervous system and then the endocrine system in separate chapters, right? We actually study them together because there are many interfaces between the nervous system and endocrine system. And this one right here with the adrenal medulla, this is the first one, okay, that we're going to talk about. Because here is an interface between the nervous system and endocrine system, and it's very difficult to separate them because they work together. They have to work together. All right, does anybody need the sign-in sheet? Okay, pass it kind of up that way. Did you come in late or what? Okay. I'm not quite sure I heard you. Go ahead, say it again. Oh, well, let's get those notes open. Let me open up those notes. Where are these notes at? All right, so let's see. I'm looking for chapter 16. No. Oh, I like that one, but we're not there yet. Autonomic nervous system. Yeah, so I don't have a lot of notes on this chapter, but I have a lot of good questions. Which one? Here? Why is the white ramus communicans white?
No.
The answer is? Not no, but because it's what? Myelinated. Name the nerve that connects a sympathetic chain with a collateral or prevertebral ganglia. That's the splanchnic nerve. All right, what's the general name for chemicals norepinephrine and epi, which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? You could say neurotransmitter, but they're not really neurotransmitters. You could say hormone, but they're not really hormones. They're what? A combination. They're really neurohormones. All right? Are the quasi-postganglionic cells of the adrenal medulla nerve cells or endocrine cells? Again, you can't say. Right? They're neuroendocrine cells. They're right at the interface or junction of the nervous system and endocrine system. All right? So you should really think of that control system is what? The neuroendocrine system. The nervous system and endocrine system have to work together. And then lastly, what's the general name of the chemical norepinephrine which is secreted from a postganglionic sympathetic neuron? What's the general name of norepinephrine? What's it's a neurotransmitter. Maybe that's what I was thinking of. It is a neurotransmitter. Commonly, epinephrine. Commonly, epinephrine right here is called adrenaline. And not so commonly, norepinephrine. Commonly, norepinephrine sometimes is called noradrenaline. But you've probably heard of adrenaline before taking a physiology or anatomy class. All right, so norepi might be called noradrenaline, but it is also what? A neurotransmitter. All right, so that's autonomic nervous system. And it's kind of a short chapter, but there's some important details, as you see. We've been talking about it for a while. And you think it's important for you to know something about the autonomic nervous system. And why? Why is it important to know something about the autonomic nervous system? It's, what does it do? It's controlling things in your body. What's it controlling in your body? Almost everything. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, right? It's controlling everything except for skeletal muscle. So yeah, it's a very important nervous system, and it's one that's manipulated all the time in people that have disease processes, like high blood pressure, for instance. All right. So this is a nice starting point for the sympathetic nervous system. All right. So next, the fun chapter. Senses. That's 16. And you've been looking at the, been doing some senses already in lab. So I probably can get through this chapter really, really fast. All right, so in this chapter, we're not going to look at all senses because we talked about a bunch of senses already in the when we started talking about the peripheral nervous system. Like for vibration, what kind of receptors did you have for vibration? Like the Pacinian corpuscle, Meissner's corpuscles, things like that. And where do you find those things? Where do you find those things? In your integument, right? In your dermis. Maybe some are more superficial. All right, but the sense organs that we're going to look at in this chapter are what we call special senses. So I would like for you to know the difference between a general sense and a special sense. And we got five special senses. And the first one is called olfaction. What's that another name for? Smell. Okay. What is the sense of taste? You would say taste, but that's pretty close. It's the gustatory sense. Gustation is taste. Vision is, of course, seeing. Hearing is hearing, right? But olfaction and gustation are two maybe you haven't heard of before. All right, and olfaction and gustation rely on chemoreceptors. So it responds to chemicals that are in the environment. So in order for you to smell something, those odorant molecules actually have to enter your nose and bind to receptors that are on olfactory nerves that are in your nasal cavity. All right. So how many different places can you feel? Oh, what's another What's another general sense besides vibration? How about if I took an ice cube and put it on the palm of your hand?
Temperature.
Temperature is a general sense, right? And it's part of the integument. So if I put an ice cube on your hand, could you tell it was hot or cold? Yeah, no problem. What about the back of your hand? No problem. What about the back of your knee? Well, you're about your earlobe. Yeah, no matter where you put that ice cube, you can tell that it's cold. Right? So a general sense just means that you have receptors all over your body. That's a general sense. So what else could we use to illustrate that? If we took a pin and poked you on your elbow, you could say what? Ouch. Right? Or your belly button. You would say, ouch. You can feel pain all over your body. So what kind of sense is pain? It's a general sense. Right? As opposed to some other senses that you have receptors for in very discrete areas of your body in one or two locations. All right, so let's take a sugar cube and put it on your tongue. All right, and what's the sense going to be? Sweetness. Now, if we took that sugar cube and put it on your earlobe, what would be the sensation?
Nothing.
Belly button? Nothing. Fingertips? Nothing. Right, so the sense of taste relies on receptors that are on your tongue, so that's a special sense. Because you only have that one location in your body where you can perceive tastant molecules like sweet, bitter, sour, things like that. Another good example would be of a special sense would be vision. So vision, if we take a flashlight and shine it in your eye, what would be your perception? Would it be sweet, sour, hot? No, you'd see a big flood of light, right? So you can see light. Now if we took a flashlight and shine it on your kneecap, what would be your experience? Well, not much. Or belly button. Could you experience anything? No, right? So for vision, again, that's what we call a special sense because you only have two places on your body. The same thing for hearing, and smell is another one, right? So if we take an odorant molecule and you put your fingertip on it, can you smell with your fingertips? No, there's probably some organisms that can, that have antennae and things like that, but certainly not people. So all special senses have special receptors in one or two locations, and usually these receptors are kind of complicated. They're not just free nerve endings anywhere. All right, so the sense of olfaction. Here we are, olfaction, olfaction, olfaction. Where do we have olfaction? Okay, so odorant molecules have to be inhaled. All right, and so here's the frontal bone. What is the bone just posterior to the frontal bone? What is that bone right in there? And my favorite bone of the ethmoid bone, right? Because the crista galli is there. That's what the meninges anchors itself to, right? So your brain doesn't slosh around inside your head. But it also has the cribriform plate with all of those olfactory foramina so that olfactory nerves can dangle down inside the nasal cavity. So if you really want to have a sense of smell, what do you have to do to smell something? Okay? If you really, if you're trying to identify a particular odor, can you take just a shallow little breath through your nose very quietly? Or what do? You kind of sniff. Because where do those odorant molecules have to go? All the way up here to the roof of the nasal cavity where those olfactory nerves are. All right, so those olfactory nerves come through the olfactory foramina, right? And here you can see them coming down, and they have olfactory cilia poking through the epithelium. And this is really strange because this is the only place in your body where you actually have parts of neurons dangling outside your body trying to sense what's going on. All other neurons are well inside your body, protected by all the systems of your body, including the immune system. Okay, and because these neurons are outside your body, dangling down inside your nose, guess what their lifespan is like? It's relatively short, okay, because they're just subjected to whatever you subject your nasal cavity to. Hot air, cold air, whatever. Right, and as a result, there are stem cells in the olfactory epithelium that regenerate and replace these bipolar cells that have a relatively short life. And I think that's pretty interesting to me because a lot of times when I think of regeneration of nerve tissue, I think that regeneration of nerve tissue is what? Has a great potential for regeneration or hardly any at all? Hardly any at all, right? So when somebody gets a spinal cord injury, then they've lost the use of their spinal cord for the rest of their life, right? But here is a case where nerves are being regenerated constantly for the sense of olfaction. And in these olfactory cilia, there are receptors for various compounds. And here is an extremely partial list of compounds that you can identify. So sometimes we call these primary odors. And when you smell something, right, it's going to be some combination of these primary odors that will then give you the impression of what it is that you're actually smelling. So, for instance, flowery is one kind of odor. Etheric is another kind. Musky is another one. Camphorous is one. Rotten is one. Stinging or an acid scent is one. And sweaty is one. And here are some chemical compounds. You don't have to remember any of these chemical compounds, and probably you don't even have to remember these primary senses right here, but it's just interesting to look at. All right, but there might be as many as 1,000 different kinds of receptors for thousands of different primary senses. All right, so there's a great deal of discussion in literature yet exactly how the sense of smell works. But in every case, some kind of chemical has got to bind to the receptor cell within the nasal cavity, okay, on these olfactory cilia. All right, so here we see the receptor cell, and it enters through olfactory foramina into the olfactory bulb where it synapses on this mitral cell, and then the mitral cell sends its axons all the way into the brain, all right, for your appreciation of that particular odorant molecule. And then these ganglia right here sometimes are called glomeruli because they're big, these little small balls right here. All right, so that's the olfactory system. And the sense of gustation is the sense of taste. All right, so taste we have on our tongue. And if you stand in front of a mirror and stick your tongue out, you'll see that it has a bunch of bumps on it. And those bumps, a lot of times, people call taste buds. All right, but I need to change your opinion. Those bumps that you see on your tongue, well, I tell you what, maybe I'll have you actually realize that by yourself. What do we got right here? What do I have the arrow on right here? Okay, this is a nucleus of a cell. Okay, I guess you guys didn't know what I was asking. What's that little dark dot inside the nucleus? Nucleolus. All right, so here's a nucleus. So what is this banana-shaped structure? That's a cell. All right, so that's a receptor cell. Now, in order to see a cell, what do you need? In particular, a nucleolus or a nucleus, what do you need to see that? You need a microscope. So if you stick your tongue out, all right, well, here is, this right here is what we call a taste bud. And you can see that it's not made up of thousands of cells, right? It's maybe 10 or 20 cells, something like that. So can you see 10 or 20 cells? If you stick your tongue out, look in the mirror, are you going to see cells like that? No, right? So what you're looking at is really not a taste bud, but it's going to be thousands of these taste buds all put together on a structure that we call a papillae, right? So what you look at the mirror is a papillae, and it's covered with taste buds. All right, so there is a pore that allows tasted molecules that are dissolved in water to enter the taste bud, and they have to bind to these receptor cells. And when it does, it sends electrical information to the brain and gives you the sense of taste. There are different kinds of papillae in different parts of the tongue. The fungiform, right, are right on the body of the tongue, more on the tip. These really big ones in the back, these are what we call the circumvallate papillae. So there are different kinds, and you actually have different taste sensations on different parts of your tongue because of the difference in papillae and the difference in taste buds arranged on your tongue.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it how different it is
Like if something's more chemical, like say latex, like I've been able to smell latex and I taste it.
Yeah.
Tasting it stuck in my mouth, like for hours. What's wrong with that?
Okay, remember I had a slide right here. Here are the primary sensory receptors. And there's a huge discussion as to how many people really have. All right, so here are seven. Some people say 1,000. Some people say, 2,000. And the reason for that is probably is that we all have a different number of receptors. So some people are going to be more sensitive to some smells and tastes than other people because somebody might be missing this flowery receptor, or maybe it's modified a little bit, so it has a different response. So it's just that we all have different sensations in terms of smell and taste. There might be another reason, too, and that is it might be just a cultural difference. You know, how you've grown up. Maybe you've just been taught to appreciate different kinds of tastes compared to other people from different cultures. Right, so that's another thing, and so researchers haven't been able to figure out what's going on there because it's so complicated. Culture plays a role, receptors plays a role, and maybe some foods that you ate last week might even play a role in how you taste things this week. All right, so there's a lot of things that could be going on there. All right, but for the taste of, or for the sense of gustation, there are basically five different tastes. You have sweet, you've got sour, for instance, due to acids. You have bitter, salt, and umami is a taste. All right, so you all kind of know what sweet, sour, bitter, and salty is. Umami is the sense of deliciousness. It gives you the sense of fulfillment when you eat something. All right, so something that produces a sweet taste would be sugar. Something that produces a sour taste would be an acid, like vinegar or lemons and limes, something like that. Bitter would be due to chemical compounds like quinine that we have in tonic water. And salt would be due to salt, for instance, table salt. Okay, and you could probably imagine all of these tastes put together. What would you have if you put sweet, sour, bitter, and salty all together? How about, what would you have? Pizza, pretty good. I was thinking more in the way of like a margarita. Okay, can you taste sweet, sour, salty in a margarita? Now, I don't recommend that if you haven't, but if you can be persuaded to do that in the right circumstances, you might try that sometime. Okay. All right, so based on the magnitude of those different components, so of course, then your gustatory cortex will come up with what kind of food you're tasting. Okay. All right, so that takes us to vision. So I'm not so interested that you know something about these pathways other than, well, this illustrates kind of a common theme. All right, where do all of these afferent signals have to stop before they get to the gustatory cortex in the temporal lobe? It can't go directly from the tongue to the cortex. Where is an important relay station in the cerebrum? It is the thalamus, right? So here is a nucleus, right? It's gray matter. All sensory information, right, passes through the thalamus, and you can see a synapse right here. And then here is the third order neuron that takes it to the cortex for your appreciation. Okay. All right, so let's move on to vision. All right, so what kind of sense is vision? General or special? It's special, right? Because you can only see things with your eyes. And there are a lot of structures. As a matter of fact, if we think of a whole eye and all the structures associated with it, some of the structures are directly related in perceiving light or photons, and other structures of the eye just help and protect the eye do its job. So just like the integument, you have skin, you've got something else in the integument that we looked at. You have skin and accessory structures like what? Some muscle in skin, some hair follicles, nails and things like that, and glands. Well, the eye has things that are necessary for vision and then accessory structures that help the eye do its job. So some of these things right? Like eyebrows. What's the job of an eyebrow? Just prevents garbage from falling down from your head into your eye. But it's also important sensory information. So if something brushes your eyebrow because of all those hair follicles right there that are innervated, you can tell if something's brushing up against your face, and then that might cause you to blink and help protect yourself from eye trauma. All right, same thing with the eyelids. You don't see with your eyelids, but they're important because they protect your eyeballs. And the name for an eyelid is a palpebra, right? And you got a superior and an inferior palpebra. Inside the palpebra, there is a gland called a tarsal gland that secretes oil onto the surface of your eyeball. Guess what the job of that oil is? Right, oil. Okay, so here is superior palpebra. Here's the inferior palpebra. Here's a tarsal gland, and it secretes an oil that covers the surface of your eye, and that just prevents your eyeball from drying out, which is really good. Okay, so when somebody has dry eyes, it's probably, this is one of the glands that's not producing enough product to preserve the cornea right there. All right, so let's look at some of these different things. All right, so here we got the palpebra here and here. Eyelashes, again, for protecting your eye, produces that blink response. Same thing for eyebrows. And there is a membrane that covers the inside of the interior surface of both palpebra, and it's continuous with the eyeball. That's what we call the conjunctiva. And you can get an infection of that conjunctiva, which is called conjunctivitis, okay? And sometimes it's viral, all right? Very, very infectious kind of disease called pink eye, okay? All right, another accessory structure, if we look at a frontal view of the eye, is the lacrimal gland, and it's superior and lateral to the eye. It secretes tears, right, through these lacrimal ducts right here. These are the excretory ducts of the lacrimal gland, and then the tears flow over your eye from superior to inferior, and then medially into the lacrimal canaliculus right here. And the orifice into the canaliculus is what we call the punctum, lacrimal punctum. And then it flows into the lacrimal sac, and then into the nasal lacrimal duct, into your nasal cavity. So that's why when you're shedding tears, like when you're crying or something, what else do you have besides tears running down your face? You get a runny nose, right? Because those tears end up in your nasal cavity as well. All right, so another job of the lacrimal gland is just to remove debris, dust particles, off the surface of your eye, and that actually does a lot in protecting your eye from infection because it's washing out bacteria and viruses from the surface of your eye, right? So that's an important immune function as well, and it prevents your eye from drying out. The space between the palpebra, that's what we call the palpebral fissure, and then that takes us pretty much right to the eyeball. All right, so here you have the eyeball itself. The most exterior surface of the eyeball is what we call the cornea. All right, the cornea is part of the most superficial structure on the eye. Oh, you know what? There are a couple other accessory structures that I forgot to mention. And that's muscles that can position the eyeball. So you can look right or left without having to turn your head or up and down. Those are due to extrinsic eye muscles. And you have 6 extrinsic eye muscles, a superior, inferior, lateral, medial, and then 2 oblique, a superior oblique and inferior oblique. And so that you can position your eyeball to concentrate on a particular object. And I'll tell you where that happens in just a little bit. All right, so here is a good example of an exam figure. So let's just zoom right in. You might want to even try drawing this thing out. Make sure you know every little piece of this thing, especially maybe even for a practicum. So the eye itself has 3 main layers to it. So let's start with the most superficial layer. That is the sclera. That's tough connective tissue. It's leathery. It's really tough. It's almost impossible to cut, even with a pair of scissors. And it's really impossible to cut with a pair of dull scissors, if you tried, like in lab, right? Okay, the next layer, deeper layer, is the choroid. The function of the choroid is that it contains blood vessels. It also contains pigments that absorb light so that when light enters the eye, it doesn't bounce around inside the eye. If it were, then you'd see flashes of light, right? So the choroid helps absorb light so that you have a nice clean image. And then the deepest layer is the retina. The retina contains photoreceptor cells. And there are two kinds of photoreceptor cells. Anybody remember what the two kinds are from lab? I'm not so sure you talked about this in lab yet. You've got rod cells that kind of look like columns, and then you've got cone cells, right? Rods and cones. And the ones that we utilize the most are the cone cells. These are the ones that you can see colors with, and they're really, really small, so you can see fine detail with cone cells. They're in the posterior part of the globe right here. So when light comes in from the cornea right through the lens, it goes right back to this region right here that's loaded with cone cells. So that's where you have your best vision in terms of acuity, which we call resolution, as well as color vision. So when you look at something, when you look at somebody, like if I want to look at you, do I look like this? No. I look straight on because then the light goes back directly to this area right here, which is what we call the macula lutea, right? And then furthermore, the very center part of the macula lutea has the fovea centralis, and the fovea centralis only has cone cells. It gives you the best vision. So if you really want to look at something, your extrinsic eye muscles are moving your eyeballs around so that the image falls right there on the fovea centralis for your appreciation. But there is a downside to having cone cells. They give you good color vision, give you good detail, but there is a problem with them. Anybody know what the problem is? Yeah, they don't function very well in dim light. As a matter of fact, in dim light, they don't function at all. So, that's a problem. You need to have bright light in order to see fine detail and color. If it's dim light, they just don't work. As you move from this fovea centralis to the periphery, out laterally or superiorly, the cone cells kind of give way to rod cells. All right, so rod cells we find in your peripheral vision right over here, and rod cells function in dim light or dark light. So that's a really nice advantage of rod cells. But there is a downside to rod cells as well, and that is they can only see in black and white. They're insensitive to color, and since they're big, you can't see very good detail. They give you a blurry image. But the trade-off is, what, you can still see some things in the dark, just not color, not a lot of detail. All right. So this macula lutea right here is associated with a really unfortunate disease process that some people have. Anybody familiar with that disease process? You've all heard of it. Okay, macular degeneration due to degeneration of the cone cells in the macula lutea right there. So when somebody has macular degeneration, they might not go completely blind because they still have their peripheral vision, not completely blind, but it's really obnoxious. Why? Because the vision that you use most of the time, day in and day out, is what? Right smack in the center of your vision at the macula lutea. So somebody with macular degeneration would be like you looking around, but put your fingertips right in front of your eyes. So what do you see? Big smudges right there. You still have good peripheral vision, but when you want to really look at something and concentrate, like that bottle, where's the bottle? I can't see it. I only see my fingertips. All right, so if you want to look at a computer screen or read a book, where does it have to be? It's got to be off to the side. Okay, so that's too bad. But there's some really nice progress being made with treating that disease. Probably not fast enough. All right, so that's the layers, sclera. Right, protects the eye, gives the eyeball its shape. The choroid nourishes the retina, right, because that's where the blood vessels are. And then the retina has the photoreceptor cells. Here is the optic nerve. That is sending afferent signals to the brain, right? Because the cone cells pick up light and then transmit and then transduces that into electrical signals that the brain can appreciate. So right here, this is where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. And since you have neuronal tissue right here, there's no room for receptor cells. There's no rods or cones in this area. So guess what you have right here in your retina where there are no rod or cone cells? You have a blind spot. You can't see anything right there. That's called the optic disc. All right, so next time I guess I'm going to start with optic disc. Remind me to start there. And maybe over the weekend, maybe you can find your blind spot. You've got one in each eye. How do you do that? Okay, maybe I would show you at the beginning of class next time. It's a little trick. But I got to go set up a practicum. So I can't do it right now.